Of the Survival Podcast, as always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 30th, 2024, and it will also be the last episode of May this year as we head into June, which will, at the end of that month, put us through the second quarter and halfway through the flipping year. This year has seemed to fly by. I want to take a minute right now and do a couple things. One, I want to celebrate a milestone in the Survival Podcast. Today is episode 3,500, and being kind of a weird pattern freak, I just like rounded off numbers, but that is that's kind of a monumentous achievement as a podcaster, not to pat my own back too hard or anything, but I don't think there's many podcasts that have been around long enough and been done consistently enough to get into that realm just of total episodes. And what I want to say actually is thank you to all of you who have helped me get here, because you can't do something for what will be 16 years next month without other people supporting what you're doing. It's not viable. I don't do this as just a hobby or just because I love it, even though I do. If I couldn't make a living doing this, then I couldn't do this every day. So I just want to take this moment and kind of acknowledge this milestone collectively as a community and say thank you so much for helping me to get here, because I couldn't have done it without you. On that, I do want to kind of do something I don't do a lot of anymore, which is kind of push the MSB a little bit today, but I don't want you to buy it today if you're not already a member. If you're already a member, you're already a member. I want you to think about becoming a member. And, investing in this community, having another 3,500 episodes, right? That'd put us at like 32 years of doing a podcast. And it's kind of like where I see this going eventually before I get too old to do it anymore. And that would be what you would be doing. And you get so many discounts that it doesn't actually cost you anything, because you get your money back if you use the discounts. But I don't want you to buy it today, and I don't want you to buy it tomorrow, and I don't want you to buy it this weekend if you're listening to this podcast before the weekend is over. I want you to buy it next week. Now, why would I say such a thing? Some of you that have been around a while know why. Because there's going to be a sale next week. I'm going to do a sale next week to celebrate the fact that we've hit 3,500. So I'll run it all week. It's probably going to knock the price to like 35 bucks. As I haven't decided yet exactly what the price point is going to be, but it will be a discount. And I don't ever want to be like running a sale next week and have somebody order, a membership this week. Right? I just feel like that's kind of unfair to do to people. So I would like to kind of point that out. The other thing I want to remind you of today, before I tell you what we're going to be talking about, is that we really are going through a crazy time in history. And I will continue to make new episodes and talk about things we've talked about in the past, bring you new content, bring you guests, whether they're super high-level experts in their field or people like yesterday that are just living a preparedness lifestyle with a story to tell. But I want to remind you that at 3,500 episodes, the catalog of information that we have is extensive. And with podcasting, there is a tendency to always want to listen to the newest stuff and not generally partake of the older stuff. With doing the rewinds and the Friday flashbacks, we have started to recycle some of that catalog. But there's shows that are back there on so many subjects that we will probably never rerun. And so if there's anything that you really want to know more about, I can almost guarantee you, if it has anything to do with homesteading, permaculture, agriculture, regen ag, preparedness, communications, food storage, we have it. And there's a very simple way to access it. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and use the search box. And just start looking for things. And you'll find that we have covered everything. And please, don't hesitate to use that backlog of content, including sharing with people, because this show only got to where it is today because of people sharing it. And a lot of times telling somebody, hey, go listen to this podcast, is not really going to get them to go listen to the podcast, because that person's thing is X, and on the day that they finally clicked the link and went and looked at it, we talked about Y. But if you know somebody's into something or looking to learn more about something, and send them an episode, that would be great. And if you think that they're not in a place to really sit through the intro segments is a first timer, tell them where to like jump to, you know, 14 minutes or 11 minutes or 9 minutes or whatever it is. You will not hurt my feelings ever sharing this show, no matter how you do it. So what are we going to talk about on episode 3500? Well, Chris Rossini and Ron Paul will talk about de-dollarization continuing and the globe-trotting United States government. I'm going to actually tie this into the show that I did on Tuesday about the last days of empire, because somebody made a really interesting comment that was like, I see where you're going, but I don't think you saw where we were coming from here. Because, you know, they pointed out there were a lot of nations out there who are having similar experiences to the U.S., but they're not empires. Oh, but are they part of the empire? And boy, I was thinking about talking that as my anchor segment today. And when I heard what Chris and Ron had to say about this, I'm like, nope, I'll just do a little segment appended to that for that topic, because they really are just right there on the periphery, and I'll dig deeper into it. Andy McCann will talk about cheat days and rest days when training and or dieting. I will talk about why I don't like to call them cheat days anymore when we have that one. I'm not saying not to ever do it, but I don't call them cheat days, and I'll tell you why. It's something I picked up in a documentary Ken Berry was in. And the person that said it, I really didn't care for. But this one statement, I was like, I'm going to keep using that. Speaking of Ken, Doc Ken Berry will talk about dealing with pregnancy-induced nausea with nutrition. Sean Mills will talk about installing and building solar well pumps, something he knows a lot about. Jeff Lawton will talk about thoughts on a failed food forest attempt. And I completely agree with Jeff's assessment here, and I'm going to maybe throw a little redneck duck farmer explanation on top of his technical explanation. Joel Riles will talk about stopping excessive dog barking, but not losing that dog's ability to bark to alert for you on potential threats. And this is something we continue to work with Belle on, because when she sees something she doesn't like, she goes psycho dog. I mean, I have never had a dog go that mental when they like see anything that's just out of place. We're working on her with that and doing exactly what Joel's saying, because I don't ever want my dogs to see something that they think is wrong and not tell me. And I'll say why I feel that strongly about it for when I respond to Joel's segment. And then we're going to talk in my segment today about a concept of state sovereignty through state-level food sovereignty. And I just want to throw some ideas out there, and I don't know how viable they are. And I'm also going to explain to you who you're fighting, because you don't know who you're fighting when you fight that battle. And if you're going to defeat an enemy, you better know who your enemy is. You better correctly identify the enemy, or you are not going to develop a strategy to deal with the enemy that's actually the enemy. And there's a lot of organizations out there that sound like they're very friendly to our type of thing in the world, and they are not. They are big, giant conglomerate supporters, even in something as simple in Texas as honey. And I'll tell you a little bit about that, what I learned from my bee mentor, Jason, about that. All right, with that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. Let's start off with Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul on de-dollarization and the globe-trotting United States government.
Use of the dollar around the world has been very important for the growth of the U.S. empire, you know, because our government spends trillions and trillions that it doesn't have, that the Fed prints. But if those dollars were confined just to the United States, we would have had hyperinflation a long time ago. We wouldn't even be talking about a dollar today. But those dollars are not confined to the United States. They go all over the world like a release valve for all this inflation. So it allows our government to grow, because all these other countries are accepting our dollars. And they have to play along, because if you don't play along, good things don't happen for your nations. So there were a few people that didn't want to play along. Saddam Hussein was one. Gaddafi was one. And you see what happens when you don't want to play anymore. So other nations, seeing this, they reluctantly use the U.S. dollar. But this has allowed our government, the government in the land of the free, to become the biggest government in history, in the history of the world. So it's now reached the point where major countries, not little countries, have had enough, like China, like Russia, nuclear powers. They don't want to play anymore. And that's why this week Vladimir Putin said 90% of Russia-China trade is now not done with dollars anymore. It's done with rubles and yuan. And other nations are also jumping on board. They want out, too, of this U.S. empire dollar domination. And they're now doing so with confidence because these major nuclear powers are doing it.
You know, in 2010, China, in their payments back and forth of what they were dealing with, they used the renminbi, the Chinese yuan, less than 1% of the time. It was just so more normal and natural and seemed to be in their best interest. Maybe they had no choices. Today, they're using the renminbi 50% of the time. So that's the kind of sign that you see, although there's still a lot of people using the dollar, but that's a shift.
It's sad for me to say, because I am an American, I love my country, but we are, as Americans, the most propagandized people in the world, the most lied to people in the world, because we have the biggest government in the world that has the resources to get us from every direction with lies, and that's exactly what they do. And so, you know, we need to stop projecting. You know, we're told that Russia is going to conquer all of Europe. What would they want to do? Europe is in bad shape. Why would they even want to bother with something like that? Or that China wants to take over the world? You know, this is the stuff that we're fed. But we have to remember, these countries are not like us. They do not think like us. And when I say us, I mean our government. These are civilizations, both of them, that are thousands of years old. We're a tiny little startup that started a couple hundred years ago, that we had great, amazing founding principles. But those principles are gone. They're thrown away. So now we're a 200-year startup with a massive ego that is trying to take over the world. You know, and China and Russia, even if they wanted to take over the world, they don't have the means. You know, they don't have the world reserve currency that they could print, that the entire world just sucks up and takes, and that they can grow. They don't have military bases all over the world. China has one in Africa. We have like 800 that are surrounding Russia, that are surrounding China, that are surrounding Iran. We are surrounding them. We don't go out and see military bases surrounding us. There are none. They're not trying to take over the world. But think of what you see when you go on TV and this. You think that we're about to get conquered by someone, you know, and they're... China hasn't been in war since, what, Vietnam? They have built up their nation, and I'm no fan of their form of government. But when you look at what has been built there, because they haven't been at war. And look at us. We've been at war forever, and our country is literally falling apart. They preserve their cultures. They preserve their... They have borders. They don't allow anybody in. They're not woke. You know, we're all three of those things. Our culture is getting decimated because our borders are open. We're woke as a joke. And we're destroying our culture. But we are so propagandized that in this situation, we're supposed to fear that they are going to take over the world, and it is.
So I want to talk about kind of how big this problem really is a little bit here. And this comment that came in from Eric on the blog, and I want to be clear, I am not picking on Eric at all here. It is very easy to take the approach that Eric is taking this and not see kind of what's behind the curtain. Eric says many other, and this is on my show about the last days of empire, and specifically I gave 6 commonalities of empires when they're at end stage. And what'll make this even have better context, let me real quick give you those 6 commonalities. Economic decline, military defeats, political corruption and inefficiency, social and cultural decay, external pressure and invasions, and environmental and health crisis. Okay, so this is what Eric had to say, and again, I'm not picking on him. I think he's doing a good job of thinking here. It's just, well, where does this go to the next level? He says, many other nations are experiencing the same symptoms but are not empires. Climate change activists, nasty, unruly behavior. Canada, for instance, condoning suicide. I agree with your assessment that these are signs of empire failing, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on why it is a global scale of problems throughout the world, and if the problem might be far bigger than just the United States empire falling. Here was my comment back. Do you not get that most of these nations are part of the U.S. empire? The U.S. became the U.K.'s proxy empire after World War II. Canada is a U.K. vassal. The EU lives off the U.S., specifically with protection from NATO, which is funded mostly by the U.S., on the back of the fiat euro that could not exist without the fiat dollar. The problem is not, quote, far bigger than just the United States empire falling, end quote. It is that the U.S. empire is, quote, far bigger, end quote, than most understand. And that's where I'm going with this. And this, like I said, Dr. Paul and Chris hit on this perfectly. We have our fingers into almost every advanced Western nation under the sun to the point where they are vassals and proxies for us, or we are in some way a proxy for them. I still say to this day that we're more a proxy to the UK than the UK is to us. The UK has become very adept at looking like, you know, a number two, number three, when they're actually still calling a great deal of the shots. And that was their plan. After World War II, they're like, we cannot afford to be the headliner here anymore. We need somebody to do that for us. And it was like, America's like, oh, we'll do it, we'll do it. Like, it just so dumb and so dim going straight into it. But, you know, when you start thinking about the U.S. empire collapsing, you have to look beyond your borders or you're not looking at an empire. No nation that operates specifically within its borders as its primary MO is likely to be an empire. And that, this is a problem with empire. You either focus on your issues or you focus on other people's issues. You're worried about telling France how to live. You're worried about telling Ukraine how to live, how Russia how to live, the Middle East how to live, South America how to live, African nations how to live, Asian nations how to live. And so since you're expending massive amounts of influence and power in these other places, that influence and power is not available domestically. And eventually what happens in your society is it begins to fail. And when it begins to fail, the people who are being failed, we call those people citizens or residents or whatever you want to call them, they begin to say, wait a minute, this sucks. How are we the richest nation in the world and I am now down to feeding my kids top ramen 3 days a week because I can't afford to feed them better? And whether that's true or not, whether that person is making bad choices for themselves where they could be feeding their children better, or whether they really are doing the best they can and that's what they're left feeding their children, either way, they're pissed. So where do they turn? Who do they turn on? Well, they turn on the political apparatus. Of course, our country has been the undisputed master of false dichotomy, convincing that the D's, the R's are the problem, and the R's, the D's are the problem. But there comes a point where everybody starts to say, wait a minute, no. No, 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 more of this bullshit. No, wait. You guys have been 100% in control, and you guys have been 100% in control, and everything's just gotten shittier and shittier and shittier, and so the people start to have some form of popular rebellion. Donald Trump is a symptom of populist rebellion. Whether you want to believe that or not, that's why. You could not have seen this occur, Trump becoming president in the mid-80s, when he was far more liked than he is today. It would have been, oh, look, it's interesting, a billionaire's running for president. He'll run the country like a company, blah, blah, blah. And then Ronald Reagan would still been president in the 80s. Okay? Like, it just, this is a populist rebellion. We're so pissed that anybody that looks like an outsider's got to be better than anybody that's an insider. That's how this man becomes president. And that's not an assessment of good nor bad about policy once he's president. It's just that's how it happens. And so what does a state do, big S state, do when this begins to occur and they are an empire? Instead of taking the resources from the far reaches of the empire and bringing them home and fixing the fucking problem that you actually have, you focus on maintaining control. That's what the state always does. Instead of saying, wait a minute, our people are pissed because of all these problems. Let's focus on solving some of these problems. Let's focus on at least reducing these problems so that people will become more compliant with what we're looking for because they'll feel like we did something. That's how governments run up to a point, and when they become full-on empires, that begins to wane. And whenever there is a problem, instead of fixing the problem, you blame the people complaining about the problem and you gaslight them. And this can only go so far till people lose their fucking minds and say, no, we've had enough of you. And this is why, in some ways, a government that you can call a democracy, even though it's not, and you can convince the majority of people to believe it's a democracy, even though it's not. And I'm not going to play your stupid semantic game right now, you people. It's a republic. It's a fucking republic. I mean, I'm so tired of you people. It is a republic where we elect our representatives through a democratic process. It is both a democracy and a republic. It's not a pure democracy, and there aren't any, so shut up, okay? Try to understand this and try and be, well, technically, to excuse you in episode 181, like the comic book guy in the fucking Simpsons. Stop that shit, okay? In a place where you people believe they have the ability to change things through election, which is a democracy, assholes, okay? They will then become much more complacent because, but if we actually, like, start hanging them from lampposts or something, we're going to violence when it's not necessary because we'll just change it next cycle. But eventually that runs out. When people start to realize you're actually in a dictatorship, in that you can completely elect one side or the other and basically everything is going to stay the same and keep moving in the same direction, then you're back to more conventional tyrannies and monarchies. In the mindset, in the way people respond to them. And this is why historically true tyrannies, true dictatorships actually did a lot more to placate the populace than democracies did. Because when you're like you have a king or an emperor or some shit like that was born into it, and the only change you have is eventually when this asshole dies, his asshole kid's going to take over. When people get far enough along that, they're like, well, we're going to do something about that shit. Some heads are going on some pikes. Not in a democracy. No. No. Not in a constitutional republic run as a democracy. Not in any of it. Oh, no, no. You see, we have to follow these principles, and we have to do these things, and if we get the right people elected, it'll be fixed. But it won't be. And the only question is, how long do people believe in that facade? And that facade is being burned by the people using it right now, in plain sight. And they're just betting that the country is so stupid, they'll continue to believe it. But in the end, the empire always crumbles. And tell me one that's still here that's older than us. Good luck with that. Moving on. Didn't plan on going that long. Let's talk about cheat days and rest days when you're training or dieting.
Hey, guys. This is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia. And I'm here to answer your health and fitness questions. And I've got one here from Olivia from California. Thanks for listening to these podcasts because, California, awesome. Anyway, Olivia, I'm going to summarize her question. Basically, it is, what are your thoughts on cheat meals and rest days? And I try to eat healthy during the week. And on the weekends, everything is fair game. But Monday is a struggle. So, yes, we'll talk about that. I find that I'm not really ever resting my body as I want to burn calories. Okay, so there's a lot going on in this question. I'm going to take this apart and hopefully hit the answers or get the actual question that you need, which is, how do I feel about cheat meals? I'm going to say, no, don't ever do them. But I'll go back and answer real life because I get it. I'm an anomaly and I don't do cheat meals. How do I feel about rest days? I'm into rest days. Your body needs somewhere to recover. But sometimes that recovery can be active recovery. It doesn't have to be like sloth recovery. It just depends on what you're doing. So let's go through this item by item. So you said that you are eating healthy during the week, and then everything is fair game in the weekend. Here's the thing with cheat meals for me, and I'm pretty sure Jack actually said this, or I stole it from somebody else. I've got nothing new under the sun. I just take other people's things and bring them in and incorporate it into my own life. So when you're taking a test and you cheat, it's usually to advance yourself in whatever it is you are doing. So if you are doing something that's cheating and it's reversing the course, and I don't think it's really cheating, it's actually hampering. So it's hampering meals, right? So what you're really saying is, I want to give up on my strictness and then eat whatever I want to, because shouldn't I be allowed to do that? I mean, the answer is yes, you're an adult, do whatever you want to do. But here's the thing, when you take a cheat meal, you're actually undoing a lot of the work that you've done and everything you've been doing. So as an example, I don't eat sugar, I don't eat grains. I do like grains and I will eat them from time to time. If we made the bread, if we specifically made it and we make it in a way that I find satisfactory, like no honey, no sugars or whatever, then I will take a little bit of piece of that, right? But I don't eat sugar, and I don't compromise there, because I know the day that I compromise and cheat on not eating sugar, my tongue is going to remember the sugar taste, and I am going to want and go down that road. I don't want to slip back. So a cheat meal, I would say absolutely not. Now, on the other side, you're like, but wait, I want to eat these other things. And I would say adjust your diet into a plan that incorporates that, that doesn't make you need and desire and just like if you're spending your entire weekdays thinking about the weekend, yeah, I don't know. I think you've created a system that is not sustainable. I would like edit it and say, hey, could you have, I'm making this part up here, could you have some chocolate chips each day, just like 3 chocolate chips, let them melt in your mouth. Could you do that and get rid of the cheat weekends where you go absolutely bonkers? And you said it yourself here, Monday is a struggle. Yes, your body doesn't want to do this. It's a system that we create inside ourselves that's not sustainable. So cheat meals, I personally say no. I would instead say, hey, let's edit the plan that you're doing to make it something that is sustainable over time throughout the ages. And maybe over time you start roping it in a little bit more, or you find you get relaxed because maybe you also need to look at what problem am I solving? Am I trying to lose weight with this? Am I trying to eat better so I live a longer life? Am I trying to remove seed oils? What am I trying to do? So depending on the goal of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, you may want to adjust that. So I guess ask another question if you have some specific things, or email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com, and I'm happy to go through your specific needs. Okay, next one you said is rest day. It's funny, if you're putting these together as if they're connected, I would totally disassociate them completely. I never do cheat meals, and I do totally take rest days. Now, my rest days are semi-active. So the other day, for Sunday on a rest day, so I basically work out 5 days during the week, and then I take Saturday and Sunday off. Saturday, I typically do absolutely nothing, maybe some yard work, but it is pretty much a nothing day. It's whatever the family your kids are into. It used to be a lot of going to soccer games and watching and driving and stuff, but now as the kids are older and they can kind of drive themselves, what I'm doing on the weekends is on Sunday we have our orienteer racing option, so we can go out for the Georgia Orienteering Club and then do a race where you run around some state park. And my daughter Evie, who's 15, says, yes, I will hang out with you old man, and we can go do this fun thing together. So my daughter says, let's hang out. What problem am I trying to solve? I need to connect with my daughter. There's only a few more years in which we can, you know, I can invest in her. So rest day be damn. I'm going to go hang out with my daughter, and she wants to go do this course. We're going to go do it. So my rest day has some fast walking and some light jogging, and yeah, I'm okay with that. And maybe Monday's workout isn't so great. That's okay. Part of my problem I'm solving is, what does it look like when I die, right? When they're up there, when the kids are talking about me, is it going to be, hey, my dad invested me and loved me? Or is it going to be, he was super fit and he always focused on fitness? I'd rather the first one than the second one. So rest days, should you use them? Yes. It really depends on how much you're doing. So if you're using hypertrophy as your workout methodology, then you definitely need to have rest built in there for those muscle groups. If you're doing something like me where it's CrossFit, it's full body all the time, you probably need rest days as well. If I could set this up correctly for myself, I would work out Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, take off Thursday, and then work out Friday, Saturday, and take off Sunday. I just can't make that work in my life. I do think resting is appropriate. I also think that doing something like stretching or mobilizing for that rest could be appropriate as well. So hit me with a little bit more details, guys. If you ever need me, you can find me on our podcast. It's CrossFit Garage, because it's a unique and unusual name, right? And then I'm also on YouTube doing videos. You can find me there @AndyMcCann42. If you got specific questions, you want to talk directly, email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. Y'all take care and stay healthy.
So I only want to hit on one thing really quick, and we'll go on to the next expert today. But the term cheat day, I absolutely hate. And I always used it myself until I heard there was some chick, I can't remember her name. She's a drama queen. She was part of one of Ken Berry's things that he did where they went down to like Costa Rica and they had a house, and it was an okay documentary. It wasn't that great. But she was really kind of the drama queen problem in the whole thing. But in spite of that, at some point she said about cheat days, I don't like the term cheat day because cheating is something you do to get ahead that benefits you. And when people use the term cheat day when it comes to their diet, it's actually something that sets them back. And I went, wow, you know what? No matter how much you don't like a person, it doesn't mean you can't learn something from them. Because what an astute wonderful observation that's absolutely correct. And just think about using the term cheat in a traditional form. For instance, I cheated on my English test and I got an A. Okay, you could say it's wrong, right, to do. You could say that you didn't really benefit because you didn't learn the material the way that you should have. But honestly, if all you were looking for is a grade and you don't really give a fuck, you totally benefited because you got a better grade, assuming you didn't get caught. So taking a risk for the purpose of having a benefit to your outcome, that would be cheating. That's cheating, right? And so if you are on a diet and you eat food that's specifically prohibited on that diet and you have goals and that's why you're on that diet in the first place, you have not benefited yourself. You have indulged your pleasure sector, right? So it's more like cheating on a spouse, I guess. But you have not benefited long term. You've actually harmed yourself. And you've done it in direct opposition to your own goals and your own agenda. So unlike cheating on the English test or the math test or the French test or whatever the fuck it is, right? Unlike that, where you can say, well, yeah, you know, if my goal was really to learn French, then I didn't actually benefit from it. But if my goal was they made me take French and I don't give two shits about it and I just need the grade so I can move on with my life, you directly did benefit. And so I look at this as, do you simply make some allowances for yourself to eat food that you wouldn't otherwise eat and not to call it cheating? And you might think that's really unnecessarily splitting hairs. Didn't you just say that people are annoying that do that with republics and democracies or clips in magazines or whatever? I don't know that it's the same here, because I think there's a psychological component, which is why I latched onto it even though I didn't like the source. And what I mean is, when we say we cheated, we feel like we got away with something to our benefit. And we're programming our mind to see it that way, and therefore it becomes, when I was a kid, we used to get beer and then go hide in the woods and sit around a fire and drink it. As a grown-ass man who can buy beer whenever I want to, unless I'm camping and it just kind of happens that way, I don't ever do that anymore. Do you know it was some of the best fun I ever had as a teenager? Do you know why? Because the dopamine hit that we were getting away with something. It wasn't just that we were drinking beer. We could have drank beer anywhere, right? I had a basement we could have went and drank beer in, like, the Foreman basement in frickin' 70s show. No one would have ever caught us or cared. In fact, sometimes we did. But going out in the woods, now the cops might catch us. We might have to run, right? Like, we were getting away with it. Plus, we could have more kids there, and the slow ones would get caught when we got away. And that made it fun. And so when you're programming your mind to think that, like, this is a benefit to me, then you're more likely to do it more. So I don't think it's really splitting hairs. And I think that what one should do is do not make it a regular thing like every weekend or whatever. That's like being an alcoholic and saying, well, you know what, I'm going to clean my act up and only drink on the weekends. Because what ends up happening is you drink almost as much on the weekend as you used to drink the whole week. But it's okay because it's only weekends. And I'm telling you that a good part of this country is addicted to sugar, even if you don't think you are, because we don't call sugar what it is. If it is a carbohydrate, it is sugar. And if you give me X grams of carbohydrate, I will give you Y grams of ethyl alcohol if I put it through a fermentation and distillation process. If you give me 10,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of bread, or you give me 10,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of potato, or you give me 10,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of pure sugar, I will give you the exact same amount of 80%, you know, or 80 proof vodka. Out of all three. And there's only one thing that can turn into alcohol, and that is sugar. And so it is gram for gram equivalent. There is no such thing as, like, slow carbs or, you know, less. It's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't eat carbs because I say so. It means that when you eat them, you should count them as eating sugar. And then you come up with your numbers for how much sugar is okay. And that upsets people because, boy, there's nothing you can do to upset a person more than to put something in very clear terms and then say, but it's up to you to do whatever you want to. That makes them really mad. So, yeah, the psychology is important. And just like that is part of the psychology of I'm cheating, I'm getting by, I'm benefiting, can be really detrimental here, in my opinion. Way longer than I planned on there. Let's move on and hear about pregnancy and nausea from Dr. Ken Berry.
Hey, Jack Spierko and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today for John from Pennsylvania. What are the possible nutritional remedies for someone experiencing nausea during pregnancy on a keto diet? So it's very common for women to have nausea regardless of what kind of diet they're on. There are several theories as to why this is. Some researchers think it's because it's so much more dangerous for a pregnant woman to eat something that is spoiled, that her olfactory senses, her ability to smell things are heightened. And so if something has the least bit of smell to it, it will nauseate her. For some women, this early pregnancy nausea can be almost disabling. It can be very severe. I love what you say about she's 35 and she's a type 1 diabetic. And usually kept her A1C above 7, below 8. But after hearing me at a conference, she decided to go keto, and her A1Cs have been 5.6 and 5.7. That's beautiful. I love that. She absolutely can stay keto carnivore for her and for the baby's health. That absolutely is going to benefit both of them. My wife, Nisha, had pretty severe pregnancy-induced nausea. And what we found was is that it was when I cooked meat, John, that the smell of the meat, and that's for many women, it's the smell. And so when I was going to cook a steak for myself, I would have to go outside and cook it on the grill. I could not even fry it in the skillet in the house. She couldn't take it. And I would bring it back in after it was cooked. She could eat a few bites, but still the smell was too much. And so what she wound up doing was eating a lot of raw things. She could still eat scrambled eggs, which are very keto carnivore. She could still eat fish, seafood, also very carnivore. But she actually started just getting a sirloin steak that was very fresh from a reputable, you know, grocery. We didn't find the steak laying beside the road. And she would slice it up, and she just started eating lots of steak tartare. And they say you want a cut of meat that's not very fatty, but I've made steak tartare out of ribeye many times. The fat doesn't bother me. It does some people. But I think she'll find that she can put a few little spices that she can still tolerate on the steak tartare and eat it just fine. She probably can eat eggs just fine, either raw or cooked. There's no danger from that. She can eat deli meat. I know a lot of pregnant women are told not to do that. That's foolishness. She can eat deli meat just fine. And so even if she regresses, let's say, back to low carb, away from keto carnivore, just to get enough nutrition in to feed her and the baby, keep in mind, this is just a first trimester thing. 90% of the time, this is gone by the time she enters the second trimester, and definitely gone by the time she enters the third trimester. This is not going to be her entire pregnancy. This is going to be a short-lived thing. So even if she has to stray from keto or carnivore just a little bit for a few weeks, it's not the end of the world. Now, I'm not giving her permission to eat donuts and Lucky Charms. I'm just saying let's eat more berries. Let's eat more other things that are still natural in one ingredient, but maybe higher in carbohydrates than she would normally eat. That's going to have a small effect on her A1C, but not huge. And in the end, all this is going to go away, and she's going to be able to eat beef, butter, bacon, and eggs and feed her body and this beautiful growing baby's body and brain just fine. This is Dr. Berry. Talk to you guys next time.
I definitely have seen the same type of thing with smell being the issue. My daughter-in-law, when she was pregnant, it was very much the case. Any strong smell. So let's say that this woman, when they hear this, goes, tartare my ass. I don't eat raw meat. You know why you get so much smell from steak when it's warm? Is because it's warm. So the other option here might be go ahead and cook that steak to the doneness that she likes, stick it in the refrigerator, let it cool down, sliced thin, leave it cold, put a little salt on it. And I eat steak like that all the freaking time, and I'll tell you why. When I cook a steak and I don't eat the entire thing, and there's leftover steak, it's like the highest best use of the beef that remains, because reheating it will inevitably tend toward overcooking, right? especially if it's the steak left over that I made for my wife that's more of like a medium, edging on medium well, than my steak, which is a very, very rare steak. My steak I can heat back up. Her steak, you try to heat it up and it just goes all the way through. And so I have found that when you're eating a cold piece of steak, you don't get that harsh aroma. Right. In fact, that might be why I like to throw a little more herbage and stuff on it, because then you get more flavor. But just a little bit of good quality salt, that might be a way to go if she says no to this. And I think it would also be just like, figure out what you can eat. Figure out what they can eat. Don't worry about trying to make it so they can eat a thing that they can't eat. So if beef is off the menu for this, then, you know, can she eat chicken? You know, I'm just saying, like. And then the other thing that I have noticed with this, in my admittedly limited exposure to it, this tends to wane pretty quickly after the first trimester. This seems to be very early pregnancy centric, and as it goes on, it kind of flips the other way where they get cravings and they'll eat shit that they would normally not eat. So anyway, just my thoughts on that one. Let's move along now and hear about solar well pumping from Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got an expert panel question from David. David says, Sean, do you have any advice on constructing a solar well pump? We've been experiencing brutal droughts in southern Kansas over the past few years, and I would like to be able to add water to my half-acre pond when rainfall is lacking. I have a good unused well about 100 feet from my pond. I will need to buy a pump that is able to lift at least 120 feet and panels capable to powering it. There are several pumps on Amazon for under $200. I've included a link to one as an example. Would like your thoughts on what I would need to build this setup, including your recommendation on a pump if you have one. Well, David, excuse me. Last year, I actually did a Kickstarter where we went through and tested a bunch of different pumps and actually wrote a white paper for this exact problem. How to pump water. What information do we need to determine the total dynamic head of the system? And then what pumps did we test to actually do that? So at the end, I'll give you a link to my website where you can find some more information. But let's answer your question. So you've got about 100 feet horizontally to pump. I would suggest using polypipe or PEX to run that 100-foot horizontal run. Poly has almost no friction loss up to about 500 feet. And it's cheap and it's easy to get and it's easy to replace if you have a problem with it. And then you need to be able to lift the water at least 120 feet. So you're talking about adding about 50 PSI of back pressure to the pump itself between your vertical lift and your horizontal run. So you're looking for a pump that's going to be able to operate above 50 PSI, and you're looking for a pump that's going to essentially run when the sun is out and, you know, of course, not run when it's not. You want to pair this with a linear current booster, okay? And the reason for this is you don't want that pump trying to run when there's actually not enough power from the solar panel. So like early in the morning when the sun is coming in at an angle, the pump will try to run, but it won't have enough voltage to do so, and it can actually burn itself out a lot faster doing this. So you're only down 120 feet. You're not talking about something significant in terms of dropping a pump down in that well and pulling it back out. So honestly, if it was me, I would go with a cheap, eco-worthy pump. You can get this pump for under $100. The pump that you actually sent to me is a 120-volt pump. The problem with that is you need to have your panels and a charge controller and a battery and an inverter in order to run that 120-volt AC pump. We're looking for a direct solar 12-volt or 24-volt style pump. And so what I would do is I would get a cheap solar panel. I would pair that with a cheap linear current booster and a cheap pump and some cheap pipe. Realistically, you could be pumping water into your pond for probably $600 or $700, including pipe costs. If you could find a local panel somewhere that's, you know, in the 300 watt range. So that's how I would go forward. I have links to all of the things that I just mentioned on the Hack My Homestead website. If you go to hackmyhomestead.com/SWP, which stands for solar water pumping, I've got a link to the linear current booster that I personally use, as well as a couple different pumps that you can utilize. And like I said, just try to find a local panel. You're not going to be able to find like one or two panels shipped to you that aren't going to be broken when they get there. So if you're not buying a bunch of panels and utilizing those for other things, then I would just try to find something local that you can drive and pick up. You want to make sure you're matching the voltage and the amperage output of the panel with what the linear current booster can actually take. And if you want to really dive into the data here, again, on hackmyhomestead.com/SWP, that's Sierra Whiskey Papa, you can go buy the solar water pumping white paper. So this gives you all the information you need to determine what your total dynamic head is for different applications using different types of piping scenarios, up to and including garden hose, as well as how to pair that with a panel. I've got friction charts on there. I've got actual pumping test data on there as well. And there actually is a link if you just go to hackmyhomestead.com on the left-hand side, SWP white paper, which will take you straight to the place where you can buy that if you want to nerd out and get all the data behind why I suggest those certain pumps. Well, that's it for me today. Good question, David. Thanks for sending it in. You guys keep getting those questions into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered. Thanks.
Great stuff from Sean, and let's move on now and hear about a food forest attempt that basically has been a failure from Jeff Lawton.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from the Southern Hemisphere. I'm just in a queue for a local rodeo, actually. But anyway, we've got this question about food forest that didn't quite work. Put in a big berm, the people, with the soil that was left over from a driveway excavation, and planted trees at 20-foot centres, which sounds a bit wide to me. It's enormously wide if you want to think about syntropics. But anyway, spatial relationship with the weeds is what you're in. So you just need to think about this. One is the spatial relationship between fruit trees and support species, and then the other one is the ground cover control. And the plants used were just not ground cover control, rhubarb, strawberries and the like. You just need rampancy. You need something that's extremely rampant, extremely fast. And usually it's going to be a smothering ground cover legume, which assists itself with nitrogen fixation. So, you know, you really haven't controlled the plant, the ground, with your own rampancy design. You've got to design with rampancy to get your support species in your fruit trees and your layers up. The first layers that you put in that are ground control rampancy types are sacrificial. They're not there for very long, but they have to be there at the beginning. So you just, your sequences are out, that's all. And actually your density is very, very sparse. So increase your density of plant species that you want for fruit and add a lot of support. Add sacrificial ground covers, right, that are going to take control of the ground for you. All right. Good luck.
Like I said, I'm going to redneck eyes this a little bit. You didn't make a food forest. You made an orchard that failed. I don't mean to be gruff or anything, but it's just like you didn't do what you do to make a food forest, which is you need to be planning enough at the establishment of a food forest that you can look at everything you planted and say 7 out of 10 of these things will be dead when this is a mature forest. And so, you know, I don't have a problem with something eventually getting to where we have big trees on 20-foot centers. But if you start there, you're not going to get the symbiotic relationship between the plants. And the biggest thing you're not going to do is you're not going to suppress diseases and pests that target specific plants, because the ones that you plant will be so few in number that they will be a dinner bell to those pathogens and those pests. And you're not going to shade the ground, so you're not going to impede weeds, but you're also not going to impede evaporation. And it's likely if you do have a ground cover here, what you have is grass, and probably a single species of grass, which is probably the worst thing that you could have, a Bermuda or Kentucky Bluestem or whatever, it doesn't matter. If it's a single dominant grass, that grass is very nitrogen hungry. It will grow right up to the bases of your tree. So what you want is a more loose, open, smothering ground cover. Like Jeff said, a legume is a good choice. You could use something like partridge pea in a lot of North America. It's an annual nitrogen fixer, very aggressive through the growth season. You could also use things like yams or sweet potato as well. Anything that'll get you good ground cover. You want multiple levels of shade over the ground. You want all of the layers. So you want the larger tree, but you want the shrubs and everything. Like if you're 20 foot center on trees, I guarantee you there's no shrub layer. There's no shrub layer in this system. There's no thought to the rhizomial layer, the vining layer, right? There's no thought to the herbaceous layer in this. A food forest is a layered system. And until you get into a layered, intensely planted system, you're trying to establish an orchard. And that's not necessarily bad, but then you have to come with a whole different type of support for your trees. You're going to need to spray, even if it's an organic spray. You're going to need to spray at bud break. You're going to need to spray at blossom. You're going to need to spray at leaf out with something. In that situation, you're going to have to probably provide irrigation. You're going to have some level of control to keep whatever ground cover you do have from encroaching into too heavily into the root zone of your trees. And that's something else I really can't get into today, but I'm going to tell you that the vast majority of the time, the people tell me they planted trees and they got poor results. When I look at a picture of the tree is too deep in the ground. If your trees come out of the ground and look like a telephone pole, they are too deep in the ground. If you cannot see a root flare at the bottom of your trees where the roots begin to spread laterally, your tree is too deep in the ground. And if you bought your trees from a nursery in a pot, it is about 99% of those trees are too deep in the pot. So if you pull the tree out of the pot, you dig a hole, and you drop the tree into the hole, and you bury the tree deeper than it was in the pot, you're really too deep. You're really too deep. And what I recommend anybody that's having tree issues does, Google the following. Sick Tree Treatment Howard Garrett. Find the article that comes up first at dirtdoctor.com and read every word of it and believe it, even if it goes against what you have been taught. Because when people follow this procedure, they get rid of 90% of their problems, which is not 100, but it's pretty damn good. And this methodology was used to save the world grand champion pecan tree in Texas. Howard Garrett oversaw that project. Again, his site is dirtdoctor.com. He's not a doctor. He's not a PhD. It's a branding thing. But after about 40 years of helping people with a natural organic way, he has earned it, in my opinion, if he wants to call himself that. Anyway, with that, let's move on. And this time we are going to hear from, who are we going to hear from? Joe Riles on barking, which you guys probably heard during one of my other answers going on from Bell. And I'll throw a little assist on that, let you know even what I just did while that was going on.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back to you guys today to answer another expert counsel question. And today's question is from John. And what he's asking is, how do I get my dog to stop barking when I don't want them to? But how do I get them to bark when there's an actual threat? Or how do I get them to stop barking without getting them to stop barking at threats as well? Right, so there's really two parts to this question. The first part is, how do I get them to stop barking when they're not supposed to? So there's two possibilities that we recommend in this particular situation. The first one is, if you don't have the time and energy or you're not around your dog all through the day, then I recommend using a bark collar. So there's a bark collar on Amazon that we use. I will get the link to that bark collar to Jack so that he can link it in this show notes here. But essentially what happens is when the dog barks, it detects the vibration from their bark and it gives them a little beep warning the first time they bark, and then the second time they bark, it gives them a little shock, and it continues to get stronger up through six different levels until they stop. And then once they're quiet for like 10 seconds or whatever, it resets back to the beep. And the dog learns real quick. They bark to hear that little beep. They're like, ooh, sorry, okay, I don't want to bark again. Right, and so those are really effective. When you first start to use that, make sure you're with the dog when they bark the first time. right? Because what will happen sometimes is they'll go ruff, ruff, because they start getting shocked, right? And they don't realize the way you make it stop is to be quiet. And so if you're with your dog and they start to do that, like they're yelping because they're getting shocked, you could just grab them and be like, easy, relax. And then they're like, oh, it stopped. Okay. And I've only ever had to do that a few times, and I've used these a lot. And I, even with the dogs that I've had to do that with, I only had to do it once, and they figured it out real quick. They were like, okay, got it. Like, when that thing makes a beep, don't bark anymore. And so that will be very helpful. The other way you can do it, what are you doing, Bonehead? The other way that you can get your dog to stop barking, if you're around them enough, and this is most of the time, right? If you're home with your dog a lot, things like that, or your dog moves with you, then whenever they bark at something they're not supposed to, you give them a correction. We use the prong collar, and I tell them, fooey it quiet. So fooey it is our verbal correction word. It means like shame on you in German. And then quiet is just stop making noise, right? And I do that until they stop barking at things I don't want them to bark at. That does take a little longer, and it takes a little bit more work on the part of the handler, so you can decide which of those two methods you want to use. Now we get to the part of, okay, now how do I get them to bark when there's a threat? The first thing you have to do in this situation is determine what are the threats you want them to bark at, right? So for me, if somebody comes near my car, I want them to bark at that person, but I don't want them to bark necessarily at a drive-thru, right? If somebody knocks on my front door or is outside my house directly, I want them to bark at that person. And so what we do is we set up the little scenarios, and let's say a knock on the door, right? And I'm sitting there with my dog, and I hear knock, 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 and my dog looks up, and I go, who's that, buddy? What are they doing here? See how he's reacting right now? What are they doing here? What's going on? They get all suspicious. I get a bark out of them, and I go, good alert. Let's go check it out. And then we go check, right? Now, once we get there and we realize, oh, that's fine. It's not a threat. Then I say, okay, it's okay. Leave it alone. And they start learning when somebody knocks or rings the doorbell, bark. Let the people know somebody's here, right? Or somebody's outside. And they'll pick that up really quick. They'll know I'm allowed to bark here. I'm not supposed to bark there. In a vehicle, when I see people in parking lots or I see the panhandlers on the road, I do the same thing. Who is that person? Don't let them come near our vehicle. Keep them back, buddy. Don't let them come closer. And then they whoop at them. And I go, good alert, good alert. You keep them back. And it'll encourage that behavior. And then anytime they see people near the vehicle, they'll start barking at them. So there's a little bit more of technique. If you want to learn a little bit more or you want to get that solid obedience foundation in your dog, make sure you check out the ad on Jack's page for Canine Academy. Click that link. It gives Jack credit, and he gets a commission off of all those sales. You can check it out. We have a basics course that teaches you your basic obedience commands, and we have a monthly course that takes you all the way through off-lead obedience, and we have an advanced course that includes all of that but also has a bunch of advanced topics in it as well. We call that the annual course. So if you pay for the annual, you get access for a year, and it has all the advanced stuff. The monthly trickles in over the first 4 months, and then you get access to everything after that, but not the advanced modules. And then the basics is just your four basic obedience commands, or your five. Sit, lay down, wait, let's go, and walk at your side. All right, guys, until next time, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy. Have a great week.
So it's almost exactly what I do, and I definitely have picked up and modified it some based on Joel, but it's exactly how I trained Charlie before I ever knew who Joel was. But there is some things that maybe I do a little differently, or my take is a little different. I'm not sure, but it might be beneficial. So one of the things I have always found with every dog I've ever worked with, and it seems like the more of they toward maybe the mongrel bulldog farm dog side, like those working breeds and things like that, that are less the shepherding breeds, which for all the, you know, for all that Malinois and shepherds do, they're shepherding breeds that have then been, you know, kind of bred with the intent of serving man a little bit more than sheep, right? But definitely like the pit mixes I've worked with, the bird dogs I've worked with, etc., this seems to work really well, and it's just a sound, and it's, oh, just that. And so when I want to encourage aggressive behavior in one of my animals, I use that sound. Like, I will grab their head and point them at, like, a predatory bird or just, you know, a big buzzard, anything that can be a stand-in for the bad bird. I'll go, oh, bad bird, oh. And it's like, oh, I got to get this thing. You know, if we have, you know, coons popping up or something like that, if they see that, I don't inhibit the instinct to chase that at all, and I encourage, oh, or someone that doesn't seem like they're doing what they should be doing around, like a gate or something like that, oh, what's he doing? Oh, he better not. And this kind of ravels them up, and then that way they're on alert, but I'll also try to, like, okay, now chill, just keep an eye on them. And if I get this response where they kind of watch and they're just like, and they're getting that little undertone, you know, okay, I see them. Good job. But I'm not really trying to stop that. I just don't want them going mentally apeshit. And then, like Joel said, at some point, if that is no longer a problem in the behavior that you're observing in the threat, it's okay. You're good. Good alert. Good job. I want them to feel good about the fact that they did it. But what I don't want is what happens with Belle right now, which is the cat walks by the window. I'm sitting on the couch, and next thing I know, there's like dog fangs 3 inches from my head as she's going mental at the window. That I get immediate fooey correction, big time, like no. Right? Because that's not, that was an alert on something that was unnecessary. And it was an over alert. And part of that is, okay, if it's a bad bird or something, going apeshit is exactly what I want. It's exactly what I want, because it scares that animal, and that animal's like, no, this is a bad place. Something's going to eat me here. Right? And that, we don't really think about that. But a hawk, the reason they're even scared to come in and attack your animal right in front of you is you're a big monkey, and you're going to eat it. That's how they think. So when they hear, hi, right now, and they're like, oh, no, they're really going to eat me. Right? But when I see a person out there, I really don't want the animal to instantly lose their shit, because I might want to know what that person's up to. I want them to not be so sure unless I decide for them to know that we know that they're there. So it's kind of a balance to me. But I do think that if you want a behavior, you can't universally prohibit it or inhibit it. You do have to encourage it, but you have to channel the way that you encourage it, if that makes sense. And I have to say, you know, part of the reason I think Joel and I have very similar but a little bit different tacks on some of this is the breed. And owning a Malinois has changed my opinion, because my opinion used to be, bring me any dog and I'll fix it quickly. And it's just a different mindset from these dogs, from just about any other dog that I've ever worked with. I've worked with mongrels, purebreeds, I've worked with Brittany Spaniels, Irish Setters, you know, Rottweilers, lab mixes, huskies, like, and like nothing has ever been this challenging. Just something to think about if you're thinking about going in that direction with your next dog. And I'll tell you, like with German Shepherds even, there is a difference between a protection line bred, light bodied, you know, male's going 75, 85 pound German Shepherd, and a chill ass, big ass German Shepherd that knows everything that he's about, like Max was. He was easy to train. He was very energetic. He used to, like, when he was young, snatch frisbees freaking 8 foot out of the air. He was an amazing animal, but he was never excessively energetic. Like, he was always easy to control. So you need to think about it, especially some of you guys are getting older. Like, what would have been easy for you to deal with in your 20s may not be so easy to deal with. So one of the things we're thinking of with dogs, just as a general thing here, is that going forward, if we get any new dogs, I don't really want a dog that weighs much over 50 pounds as a mature animal. Because as I get older, you know, one of the real struggles we had with Charlie as his health failed is I couldn't really take him to the vet. Fortunately, we have a vet that takes some effort, but we can get him to come here. Because I couldn't lift him into the truck without hurting him, and he couldn't get in anymore. And I don't want to be in that situation, so I figure I've got a good 20 years left in me of being able to pick up a 50-pound or lighter animal safely and put them in a vehicle. Where I, you know, 100 pounds, that's a different thing when you're trying not to hurt the animal. 100-pound sack of potatoes, no problem. 100-pound pit bull that you're going to hurt when you pick up, new. Anyway, moving on. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about a form of political activism. And it's a form of political activism that some of you may be shocked to hear me even talk about, because I'm so anti-political. I don't believe in voting. And when I say I don't believe in voting, I mean I don't believe personally that I'm going to vote when I know that my vote isn't going to matter, because I don't do things that don't matter. And nothing you can say to me with your emotional fallacies and your appeals to authority and all of your bullshit can change the fact that I can do math, I can look at where I live, I can understand the electoral system and how it works and go, nothing I do as far as voting is going to change anything. You don't have to agree with me, but it won't change the fact that mathematically that's the case, and that in most of those elections, I don't want anybody that's in that election. I don't want anybody. I don't want any of them. So I'm not going to do it. And so when you talk like that, people think that you're completely opposed to any political activity. Well, I'm not. I'm opposed to pointless political activity. And I think there are two avenues of political activity that actually still have some real world result today. One is judicial activism, and the other is legislative activism. So judicial activism is you pick something like the government doing that they shouldn't be able to do, and you see if you can sue them out of being able to do it. It's an uphill battle, but honestly, if every person that spent all their time telling me I need to vote were to pick one issue and become part of doing something about it that way, we'd get way more done. We'd get way more done, okay? Way more. But that's not what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about more legislative activism. And this is where you try to get legislation passed that inhibits the authority of government to get in the way of people's rights to do things. And there is a lot of movement right now, psychologically in people's minds, toward more state sovereignty. Now, for all the bluster and all the talk and all the Red Dawn fantasy bullshit and everything, there really isn't for the concept of, let's say, secession. And there really is no clear avenue toward, like, county-level secession to another state, which is what's going on in, I think, Washington or Oregon right now, where there's this group of people that have gotten, like, 18 counties together in one of those two states, and they talk about joining Idaho. And this is something that can be done, but can only be done if the state that's being left approves it. Okay? And so I don't think that's going to work very well either, at all. It'd be a nice thing, but it's what I would call a wonderful fiction. But legislative action from the standpoint of getting laws passed or repealed, I think has the ability to influence things, because at the end of it, something of known quantity is the result. And this is what I mean. Let's say we decide, hey, we're going to make Texas even more conservative than it is, and we're going to pick, like, the five districts in Texas that are the most purple, but they tend to go Democrat, but they are close. They're not like the landslide Democrat districts. And we're going to focus a tremendous amount of effort, and we're going to flip those districts, and we're going to increase Texas's impact and the total number of Republicans in the federal House, and we're going to make the state House even more dominated by Republicans than it already is. Great, and you go do it, and it works. You get 100% results. You flip all five of those districts. You know what's going to happen in reality? Not much. Not much. But if we got a law repealed that says the citizens cannot do A, and that law gets repealed through legislative action, citizens can now do A. A difference has been made. Or if it's, maybe it's even the empowerment of state government to replace the actions of federal government. And I think in the food sovereignty movement, and somebody's going to say, they already do that in Indiana or something. Various levels of this exist. That is the point, right? I love when you tell somebody we should do it. Well, somebody already did it. Well, then it's doable, so you're making my point. Let's get on with doing it. And what I would like to see, and I think Texas, it's an embarrassment to me as a Texan, that this hasn't happened in Texas. There's a lot of things Texas's legislature embarrasses me about. How long it took for us to become an open carry and constitutional carry state when states like Virginia beat us to it is pathetic. How long it's taking us to truly decriminalize cannabis and be beaten by the buckle of the Bible Belt, Oklahoma, in that is embarrassing to me for someone from Texas that says Texas cares about liberty. But the place I think we have a real chance to do something, and I know why we have it, I'm going to get to that in a second because that's important to understand, is food sovereignty. And specifically in the arena of livestock processing. It's a pretty easy state. Texas is a pretty easy state. If you want to farm lettuce and spinach and start selling it to yuppie soccer moms or restaurants, it's freaking easy to do. If you want to sell beef to people that buy quarter cows or bigger, it's pretty easy to do. Everything else is a freaking nightmare. It's a nightmare to get anything done. And there is a tremendous amount of lobbyist money that really would be typically more the money that would be spent at the federal level spent in Texas because we're so daggone big and we have so many resources that we could distribute within the state's borders that right now compete at national border levels. Like beef. Do you know how much beef Texas produces? Holy crap. There's no reason for an ounce of beef to be imported to the state of Texas. Not 1 ounce. Now, if we want some Kobe beef that's the real Kobe beef from Japan, those are, I'm talking about day-to-day, what you go to the supermarket and buy. There is no reason, it makes no sense, that we have people in Texas eating beef from Brazil, Argentina, and New Zealand, and Australia, and Texas beef that's grass-fed is going to Europe. There is no reason for that other than they make more money that way. All the conglomerates, all the distributors are making the money, not the ranchers. Okay? So what I'm proposing is the state of Texas should enact legislation that allows for the following: a slaughter and processing facility for any and all livestock, including the ones not recognized as livestock by the federal government, that makes it very difficult to sell at an affordable level, like rabbits. I don't care what it is. I don't care what it is. They should make it incredibly easy, but not free. Jack, you're giving money to government. To improve our position as a political pragmatist, in this instance, yes. Because the objection is going to be, well, everybody's going to die. So the same guy that processes my half beef, if he chops the processed beef into T-bones and they go to a store, everybody's going to die, but I'm completely safe eating it. This is how stupid this is. So to understand this, you have to understand who the enemy is. The enemy is big food, even at the state level. And it's across everything, including bees. So there was some regulation that was going through the Texas State House a few years ago that didn't succeed, that would have made it way easier for beekeepers in Texas to distribute and sell their honey. And who was the primary opposition to this? Well, the Texas Beekeepers Association, right? Who said Texas beekeepers don't want this. And of course, since they had money and a name like that and everything else to go along with it, well, the legislature's like, well, we're doing what we're supposed to do then. We're serving the beekeepers of Texas. No, you're not. Anybody can call themselves anything. My bee mentor, Jason, is like, there is not a single small scale, like 100 hive or less, Texas beekeeper that's part of this thing. It doesn't exist. They're not there. This is a national organization with a state-level name that's a lobbyist organization that tells legislators which shit to pass. You're dealing with big food. Right now, for instance, if you want to process chicken and sell it like in parts and pieces in stores, it has to be processed in a USDA facility. That facility will be required to have a full-time inspector from the federal government present at the location at any time it's operating, which is 24/7, so you need like three of them, okay? I'm not kidding. They have to have their own office, and everything has to be paid for by the processing facility. And they don't get paid as an employee of Tyson. Tyson pays the bill for a federal employee with all federal benefits. Starting to see the problem here. Now, Tyson's like, oh, we hate this. No, they don't. Tyson, Purdue, all these big processors, all these big producers love this because they grow 40,000 chickens in a longhouse, you know, where like 20 to 30% of them die and have to be hauled away to bucket loader. And they're walking around in their own shit, but they have a complete, you know, python-like grip on the whole industry. So why can't Texas say, if it's made in Texas, grown in Texas, and sold in Texas, piss off? And the answer to that question is, there is no reason. Legally, there is no reason. But there are a buttload of big food lobbyists who have much more control over the state legislature than you do. So the only way to overcome that is to make such a populist, remember? Like, how does a Donald Trump become president? A populist insurrection is what installs an outsider. A populist insurrection is what installs populist legislation, which I think if most people in your state, Texas or not, understood what's being proposed, they would be okay with it. It's not anybody anywhere could just open up a processing facility and, like, I don't know, club baby seals in the back room while they process cattle that are not refrigerated for 17 days and have maggots in them and gangrene and salmonella when they're distributed. That's not what it is, which is exactly how Big Food would paint it. It would be there, and we already have this in Texas, just not as organized enough and not directed to the point. State-level inspectors that inspect the facility at random intervals. That's it. So Bill the inspector shows up. Hey, Tom, I'm here to inspect your shit and make sure that you're not feeding people maggots. Now, if you go to facilities in Texas already doing this type of slaughter, because they exist, who does my meat for me? I just can't resell it. See the problem? Okay. So, if you test those products that come out of there, chicken, beef, lamb, anything, for pathogens in a laboratory, and you check fucking Purdue or Tyson chicken out of Albertsons, the pathogenic load of the FDA-approved inspected bullshit is through the roof, to where anybody that would even touch raw chicken in this country out of that system and then touch their mouth without washing their hands first is begging for a case of salmonella. But like Joel Salatin's chickens, when they were tested this way, were so low that the laboratory thought they messed up. There's like nothing. Because it turns out when you keep food in a clean way, you end up with clean food. So I think we need a whole movement and template for this movement, how to get this done. Because if I had my way, like if I was Texas governor, this shit would happen. I would keep, because the way the Texas legislature works, I would just call emergency session after emergency session after emergency session and keep their asses in Austin until I got what I wanted. That's what I would do. And I would say, anybody can apply for this. We have to put the bean counters on it, and we have to put in a reasonable number for what you pay to get licensed and what you pay annually to stay licensed. It doesn't need to be a lot of money, and we need a trained workforce. But if you want to slaughter rabbits, go ahead. You want to do chickens? Go ahead. You want to do everything? Go ahead. As long as you meet the basic requirements, humane slaughter, you have a valid and good way to dispose of your waste, so you're not creating an environmental crisis. You have to think about that too. And the end product is solid, and there is some mechanism to ensure food safety. Let's go. Now, there's no good reason to say no to that. Unless you're Tyson. Unless you're, you know, one of the few major beef packers in the country that still has control over everything, then this is a disaster. Because if Texas does this, as Texas goes, so does the nation. If Texas does something like that, and what it would do for our local economy is huge. Do you know how much money leaves Texas because people are buying beef from Brazil? They don't even know they're buying beef from Brazil. They have no idea. I went to the local grocery store and bought beef. It must be low. It's not local. The cow down the road, if it goes to the sale barn and gets sold into the meat, especially if it's grass-fed, it's probably going to end up in France or Germany. And you're eating Brazilian beef that probably should stay in Brazil most of the time. Brazilians like beef. I don't know if you know that or not. We could build massive amounts of local economies off of this. If I had this option, I would probably raise somewhere between 500 and 1,000 chickens a year. And with my ability to market through my show and through local mediums, I would sell every single one of them that I didn't want for myself. And if all I had to do was grow the chicken, deliver the chicken, and collect the money, I would probably run two cycles, maybe three cycles a year of something unique. I'm not doing it any other way. If I can make $10 a bird, that's only $10,000 off 1,000 birds. I do not have it in me to do the processing and then to only make $10,000. And that's if I make $10 profit a bird. And I think it's very reasonable to do. especially if you can streamline and go into economy of scale with processing, because the place that processes my birds right now, chickens are $4. $4 to process. I can't afford to do it at that rate. You have to be set up specifically for doing this day in, day out to process and make a profit at that number. And they do it. And they do it right now. And anybody anywhere in the state can go down there tomorrow with 25 chickens, drop them off alive in crates. They'll come back in about 3 days, and all your birds will be processed. Whole birds, cut up, whatever you want, they'll do for you. Completely safe. No one dies. But if we let it be sold in a second store, everybody's going to die. We need this. There's more that can be done with this form of political activism at the state and local level than anything else that we can possibly do to influence government. And we need it for another reason. It's not just to make change. It's that all the other bad shit we're talking about is happening. It's going to continue to happen. The empire is going to collapse. They are going to tell you to stay in the pod, eat the bugs, own nothing, and be happy. And we need to build more infrastructure for food production and distribution in our local markets. And the only wall that we can put up between us and them is through the sovereignty of states within a republic, which is also democracy. Just got to throw that dig in there. Anyway, that's my thoughts. I'd love to see more done with this. And again, I know I'm going to, but Jack, they already do that in Indiana or wherever. Yeah, I don't care. I don't care. Do they do it everywhere? No. Then let's do it everywhere. And do they do it right? Is there room to improve? I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. There's always ways around this. I grew turkeys several years. I made lots of money on them in several years. I gamed the system. But instead of raising 20 turkeys, the same amount of effort, I could have raised 100 and made a hell of a lot more money if I had the distribution system on my side instead of stacked against me. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why are they so afraid of the small farmer? They're not, but they're afraid of thousands of them. They're terrified of thousands of them. And they'll come up with a million reasons it can't work, including bird flu. And it's all bullshit. Anyway, with that, let's move along and wrap things up. I want to remind you guys, if you like my show and the work that I do, one of the ways you can help support us is to do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Item of the day today is from Vore. Probably the last time I'm going to bring it around for a while as we move on to some other things. I got some products to review this weekend for you from Vore, by the way. A really badass collapsible ladder. Really badass thing. It's awesome. I just, with everything went on the last 2 weeks, I haven't got it up yet. And a very cool cooler. Very, like, a cooler that will freeze things while you drive down the road in your car, or you could use it as a backup in a lot of different situations. It's awesome. They have a lot of options for that. But today's item of the day is the worm farm. The Vivor 5-tray worm farm. This thing is awesome. It is on sale. It is super inexpensive, and it is an exact reproduction of what is one of the best-selling and best-thought-of 5-tray worm farms on the market, because it's the same damn thing from the same OEM for about $40 less. I have been using mine now for like 3 weeks. I am very impressed with its functionality, and I need to do some update videos on it, but definitely consider getting into worm composting. For a lot of you guys, especially smaller properties and all, it might be all you really need. And you can make some of the best compost in the world. There's a few rules to follow, and otherwise, it's not hard to do at all. And I just recently did a podcast talking about worm composting. So just go to the site and look up worm composting if you haven't heard that one yet, and you'll see why I recommend this product so highly. With that, again, remember, I got a sale coming for you for MSB starting Monday. So if you've been thinking about becoming a member, wait till Monday. With that, it's been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. You out, just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.